the system of marriage within the religious world, the ultra-Orthodox world, the system of arranged marriages. I'd like to talk a little bit about what it is and some of the misconceptions and the way the system works, and then we discussed it last night in detail, but there weren't any questions, and today I thought it's better to have a conversation about it so you can ask the things that are of interest to you. So feel free to interrupt and ask anything that may bother you. But just give me a few minutes first to paint a picture of some of the relevant details. This is not only aimed at people who need to get married. That means if you happen to be of the right age to get married, which is about 17. You shouldn't put it off till beyond then. Even if you are contemplating a second marriage, or I don't mean while you're still married. Or if you're old enough to not have that problem anymore, but you have children or grandchildren, so you need to know this information so that you can interfere properly. Okay, there's a lot of discussion that's needed that we won't have time for today, and you can refer to the recording of last night's discussion with regard to the pain of what happens in the secular world now and the terrible consequences in terms of lack of marriage altogether and the divorce rate and many other problems in terms of how people use each other, and there are mixed agendas that are in the background, and the problems that the secular world is experiencing now. I think you hardly need to have it made explicit. If you just look around, you'll see what the problems are, and it's quite obvious how these problems are solved to a large extent by the system that the Torah world has adopted or has always used. In fact, just to make one comment about it that we didn't mention last night, something that always strikes me, that I always find as a bombshell to be able to put across. I happen to be involved, most people in the religious world these days are involved in teaching people who get married. You're probably aware that now there's a system that operates now in Johannesburg where any couple getting married, they're required by the shul to go to a couple who teach them. The woman goes a few times to learn about the whole issue of nida and the nida laws, and the husband or the groom comes at least once and learns with the male part of the pair what is required in terms of marriage in general, some of the more intimate things and also some of the general approach to marriage. And very often the question that's asked, I'm sure a lot of people ask the question, is how can an artificial system of arranged, something that's arranged, especially if it's arranged by parents and the child has very little say in it, how can the system, so artificial and it's so unnatural, how can it work? Very often the way the question is put is much more sharply, and the question is usually, how can you be sure that a marriage will work when you haven't experienced each other? In other words, you need to have a full relationship with each other so that you can be sure that you're compatible, that the marriage will work. Baruch Hashem, you don't even have to answer that question, you just have to show the results. Because if you look at it now we have the ultimate weapon or the ultimate answer in our hands, which is the fact that the secular world now is engaged in exactly that. There is a full exploration of the relationship before people get married. The fact is that now in non-religious circles, there is not just a full relationship that takes place before marriage in almost all cases, but in many cases they actually set up home together. That's the norm now. People actually live together in every way. They actually set up a experience of living together, and often for months, at least if not years, before they actually get married. So that there's no question of a testing of compatibility. And those who do get married, having spent months or years together, you might argue, or certainly feel compatible. You know, taking the step of marriage, which is remarkable in that system, because they already have all the details of the relationship and they already have all the privileges of marriage. So when they get married, all they're taking on, especially the male, is just the obligations. So you must really feel committed when he gets married. And yet the divorce rate now in Johannesburg is over 50%. The divorce rate now is over 50% in good, old-fashioned, standard, conservative Johannesburg Jewish community. We're not talking about Southern California or places where the divorce rate is much higher. And you have to understand that there the divorce rate is higher among people who hardly get married. Not just that the divorce rate is higher, there you're talking about a much lower percentage of people who get married in the first place. But here in Johannesburg, where we still have, by the acknowledgement of most of the Jewish world, a very conservative, old-fashioned, level-headed, balanced system, we've now reached a divorce rate that's more than 1 in 2. And in many cases, these divorces are in the first few months of marriage. I've personally been involved in a number of situations where the divorce has taken place within a year of marriage, after the couple lived together for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, quite happily. Now, the fact is that you're dealing with a divorce rate where full compatibility has been checked out, and the divorce rate is over 50%. In the religious world, where the couple never, maybe only looked at each other once in the ultra-Orthodox, what they call ultra-Orthodox circles, or certainly had no, you know, meaningful or no intimate contact at all before marriage, then the divorce rate almost zero. And intimately, I can tell you that the marriages work. They are certainly, on average, happier than marriages in the secular world, and they certainly work. And I can tell you, as a doctor, working intimately with people in those communities, that certainly there are problems. Definitely there are problems. And the divorce rate is rising. There's no question. The divorce rate is rising precipitously in the religious community. But it's still well under 1% compared to the chance that your child will now get divorced in the secular world, which is better than that they won't. So now, that's your answer. And if you ask the question, where was compatibility tested, it certainly wasn't in the religious world, and things are fine. So obviously the answer is not that you have to check it out and experience compatibility beforehand. Obviously the answer lies someplace else. And the answer is complex. It's not only, it's a whole spectrum of religious values, it's aims that are set up by the couple when they get married. It's many things, not just the shidduch system, it's many things that are in the background, it's a common purpose, it's a sense of identity, it's a sense of goal or aim outside of the relationship. There are many things that make it work. And because those things make it work, it often works in an extreme way. The case that I like to mention is, most of you probably know him, he comes to a certain Yerushalmi who comes to Johannesburg quite often. He's a charismatic personality, many people know him. So I heard from a friend of the family how he got married. What happened was, when he was a young boy, his father came home one day. He lived in Meir Shearim. Old time, many generations Yerushalmi family. His father came home one day and he said, "Nochem, put on your Shabbos clothes." So he said, "Why, Abba?" His father said, "Never mind, put on your Shabbos clothes." So he got dressed in his Shabbos clothes and they walked across Meir Shearim to Gaula someplace, and they went into a house in Gaula, and his father said, "Nochem, say hello to your colour." So he said hello, and they said, "Mazel tov." Then the men had a party in one room, the women had a party in the next room. And on the way out, as they went out, his father said to him, "Say goodbye to your colour." So he said, "Goodbye." So he said, "No, not that one, that one." And they got married. Just for completeness, I'll tell you the rest of the story, that unfortunately they weren't able to have children for a couple of years, number of years. And in those days they went to the Chazon Ish for a brocha. And the Chazon Ish gave them a brocha for Chai Banim Chaim. Yes, he gave them a brocha, they should have 18 living children. You hear that? They just had their 19th, to be honest. Now, I see here some pale faces of the mothers of children who are getting more involved in the religious world. I can see some tension over here. I'm not suggesting that you have to do it that way and, you know, with all those details, but be it as it may. So let's just understand some of the... What I'd like to do is try and focus on some of the details of the system that are relevant to people who are not in that mode. That's what I think is most important, again, to suggest that if you happen to be thinking about a more orthodox, a more Torah-oriented way of life in Johannesburg society, that you then take your 16 or 17, 18-year-old daughter or son and arrange a marriage against their will and throw them, you know, that is just not going to work. However, there are two things you can do. One is, if you can wisely steer your children towards a more Torah-oriented way of life, even if you're not idealistically motivated in that direction, you're giving them a lease on life and a chance for happiness that they almost certainly won't have in the secular world. Right? By getting them to see the wisdom and the beauty of the purity and cleanliness of relationships as they set up in the Torah world and what it can lead to. And secondly, even if you're not doing that, but there are many elements of the system that you can incorporate for yourself or for those you have to advise, even if you don't follow the structure of the system in terms of arrangements as such, but still in terms of the criteria and what people in the Torah world look for in terms of whom to marry, those criteria are valid across the board whether you have that mode or you don't have that mode. And I'll try and bring out the elements that are relevant to everybody no matter what your particular lifestyle or structure is. Give me just a few minutes to make some basic points, and then please note down if you have something that you wish to ask. The issue, first of all, to be diffused and understood, is not that it's arranged against the will of anybody. That's not what anybody wants. Even in the most ultra-Orthodox circles, there's first of all a halakha that the people have to approve. The marriage is not binding unless the woman approves. There's no question about it. There's a halakha that a man must see a woman before he marries her, no matter how wonderful she is in terms of all the criteria that can be stated as statistical facts about her personality and everything else. it's not valid unless they actually see each other, because the first characteristic, the first criteria, remarkable, the first criterion that halacha recognizes is that there has to be a chemistry. There has to be some sort of natural attraction, including a physical attraction. It has to be as strong as possible. There's no question about it. I'm not saying it's the most important part of marriage, but it's a critically important part. And therefore, there's no such thing as arranging things against the will of. That's not the point. That's not the point. And secondly, the second point to know is that where it is done close to that, it is a system where it doesn't make any difference to the children anyway. You understand this? So understand that a family that lives in Maya Sharim, the expectations of what marriage is and the format that the marriage will take are so clearly defined for those people anyway that it isn't a problem in the first place. They don't have to thrash out a whole set of values and how they'll live and where they'll live. All those things are taken care of. A young man getting married in Maya Sharim can be assured that the girl he married, that his parents pick out for him, who lives down the block and has done so for the last 10 centuries probably, her family. Right? Probably, my Rebbe told me once, that his grandmother was born in a room where her mother had been born, and her mother had been born for 13 generations, and he thought in the same bed. He wasn't sure about the same bed, but the same room, can you imagine? With all the turmoil of Eastern Europe, that's the stability that had been there. So when a young man chooses a girl in that context, he may be sure that she'll be exactly like his mother. And she can be sure that he'll be exactly like her father. There's no question about it. Way you'll dab it, and exactly the way they'll do things, and the whole format of the home, and the whole ideology and what they'll do, all already organized for them. Of course there's problems of compatibility and adjustment and person, of course, but at least it's only that. You don't have the broader issues that today couples have massive problems on, because he wants 25 children and she wants to be sterilized. That's the kind of problem that you have facing you today. Basic issues that there's no understanding at all. Of course you don't have those issues. So first of all, those problems don't arise in that kind of a situation. But secondly, even if you're trying to approximate what you can of that, all the poskim, all the halachic authorities say quite clearly, anybody who works in this area states clearly that no matter how religious you are, no matter how frum the young person is being, they should not use that system. Again, they shouldn't do that. They should maybe meet somebody using the benefit of how the system operates, but they should know the person for a long time before they make a commitment. Just meeting them once and having the approval of the parents is not enough for people from our background. Even if you've moved very much into the yeshiva world and you've assimilated those values and you live that way, but there's enough of a hangover of secular concepts that we have that will make it very, very difficult and very unsuitable. And therefore you should know each other for a long time. Rabbi Gottlieb is one of the people who probably works the most in this field in Jerusalem. He always says that he always tells the boys in yeshiva that they should know a girl for 8 months before they get married. He said nobody bothers to listen to him, so now he says 4 months in the hope that somebody will listen. They still don't listen anyway. But the point is that ideally, no matter how frum you are, how common your ideology, we have enough hang-ups that we bring over from our secular view of things that we need to have much, much more. Yes, and if anybody wants to know how long, and here we come to the first rule, the young person wants to know, the young person asks you, how long should they know each other before they commit themselves to each other? It's often a very painful problem, especially for the male. Women are much clearer in this area. They know exactly what they're doing and what they want. It's usually young men who are horrendously thick-headed about it. They want to know how much longer should they know the girl before they make a commitment. The answer is, until there's no new information coming in. That's the answer. That means, while you're getting to know this person and there are still surprises in store, so it's too early to commit yourself. You have to know the person long enough that there is no new information coming in. That means you've seen the person long enough to have a feeling for who they are as a personality. You have now experienced them. Experienced this person in different circumstances and situations. You've seen them with their family, you've seen them in situations where they may be under stress and tension, and you're not likely to see any new information. You're not likely to see them in situations that will bring out a new basic facet of their personality that you weren't aware of before. If yes, then you need more time. If not, then what are you waiting for? What new information are you going to gain here by having more time spent with this person once you already have a feeling for their entire personality? There are always surprises, and personality changes after marriage radically, especially women's personality. Especially women, the day after marriage, a woman's personality changes entirely, and women should be educated how to avoid making that too obvious. That's another lecture we have to have some other time. So the point is that that's what happens. You refer to the discussions that we had here a few months ago on marriage. There are two types called Marriage 1 and Marriage 2 that deal more with the mechanisms and intricacies of marriage, not the system that leads up to it, and you can refer to those discussions if you're interested. Now, so what does one approximate, what does one use of the system? So first of all, the idea of meeting, the meeting itself, let's discuss that briefly. Before we do that, let's make a more important point. That no matter how much, the mistake you can make here let's try and point it out. The mistake you can make is by getting too hyped up about the system, you can start using the system so carefully that you forget who you are as a person. One of the major problems that people have in the religious, in the cross transition, in the transition from secular to religious, this is a classic Baal Shuva's problem, is that we move from a secular mode into a religious mode and become so hyped up on the rules and the system that we forget to be human. That's a classic problem. And then you start operating according to that, and you can make a bigger mess than if you'd remained in the secular situation. I remember a friend of mine in yeshiva who came up to me one day and he said, could he speak to me about a certain young lady that he was meeting? So I said, yeah, as a friend. So we sat down outside and he started telling me about this girl. She happened to be, she's not a South African girl, and it doesn't matter. So he started telling me about her. She was wonderful, this girl. She was wonderful. She was fantastic. She was a tzaddikus, and she had Yerushalayim, and she was just like a long list of the most fantastic characteristics. So he went on and about this for about half an hour, about how wonderful she was. And then there was a trailed off into silence. Then I said, do you, fine. So I said, do you like her? So he said, no. So I said, that decided, doesn't it? So he said, yep. That was the end of the conversation, end of shidduch, you know. So I said to him, listen, you go back. I was very upset with him. I said, a wonderful boy, a wonderful, good-looking, talented, beautiful South African. I said, listen, you go back on your next date with the next girl that you meet, and you behave exactly like you used to do on the Durban beachfront. I mean, you clean it up, of course. You've got to make it kosher. But the point is, you use the same natural talents that you use there. Otherwise, how are you going to... Marriage is hard enough when there's a natural connection. You're going to function according to rules. Baruch Hashem, got married, very happily married, everything's fine. The point is that you can forget the most important elements, much more important, in fact, as I'll try and show you, having a normal, decent, giving, loving South African background is much more important than all the rules put together. There's nothing that can equal that. Nothing that can equal an affectionate, giving, loving, sensitive, generous nature. It's worth all the rules in the world. So you can't afford to forget that to apply some sort of a system. But the way the system does work is this, that instead of meeting by accident or in an environment, and I'll try not to spend too much time knocking the secular system, but instead of meeting by accident or in a system where the whole set of values is guaranteed to make a first impression that's on the wrong wavelength, so the couple meet in a way where the whole environment is structured that there should be the right wavelength. Let's try and understand that. In the secular world, again, usually the people who have the hardest time with this are feminists, the old style feminists, and you'll see that nothing could be more feminist than the Jewish way of doing it. In the secular world, what happens is, instead of meeting somebody intelligently whom you're going to assess whether you could spend the rest of your life with, I mean, the irony of it is that if a person, people spend more time these days assessing the details of a motor vehicle that they're about to buy. You know that? Most men these days spend more time assessing. If you assess the number of hours they put into the next car they're going to buy, you'll find, boys, do they check it out? Do they know exactly what to fix? Do they tell you exactly why each knob and button is necessary and why each rand is well spent? You know, they really become an expert. But how much thought did they put into the woman? They're going, zero, none at all. They met by accident. He was strolling across the campus lawns and across his field of vision past something that looked like it was about to take a bath, usually. And so he spotted, his attention was focused on the physical immediately. And from there, things just happened. You know, the next time he saw was 2 milliseconds out of every 10 when the strobe lights were, you know, flashing and in a haze of non-tobacco smoke. Anyway, be that as it may, the point is that, and coke isn't what it was. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is that the relationship just develops, and by the time that you get to a situation where marriage is being considered, the whole thing is a radical tangle of emotions that can't be sorted out from compatibility, and the whole thing's a mess. And the whole thing was got going on the wrong basis. And of course the thing crashes because it was predicated on a basis that quite clear in Chazal. Chazal say that a love that's based on something outside of the love is doomed to failure. And a love that is based on the love itself is destined for success. If love that's based on something, then you're lost, because when the something disappears, the love disappears. And if the love is based on its own motivation, then you're always safe, because no matter what happens, the love will be there. And this relationship began because of something else, whether it was the shell of the body or whatever it was, it wasn't the love itself. Whereas in a meeting that takes place according to the system that the traditional community uses, is that first and foremost, the relationship is set up in such a way that the two have halfway an idea that they'll be compatible with each other. That means this is another problem that people who arrange shidduchim sometimes are very insensitive, and they're so keen to make a match that they put two people together who are hopelessly unsuited to each other and they have an agonizing evening together. But that shouldn't be done. You should try and go to people who are skilled and sensitive so that the two people who meet each other have a chance, at least. No one can predict what the natural chemistry will be, but at least that the general basic background factors and outlooks will be suitable, you can do, and therefore the people meet each other with some kind of a common ground in the first place. Secondly, they meet each other with a seriousness. Instead of meeting each other by accident and getting their emotions entangled, and any two people can get their emotions entangled with each other if they're left alone long enough together. Now, it's not, doesn't mean that you're made for each other just because you happen to have engaged your emotions, it's just because you spent enough time together. But these two people are meeting with a basis of seriousness. That means from the very first meeting, they're assessing whether this relationship could work on the long term. So the whole thing has an electricity and it has a depth and a seriousness to it, and a lack of frivolity that the secular world doesn't know. Thirdly, and here's the biggest irony, the relationship in the frum world works in such a way that there is a mature meeting of two human beings. You cannot focus on a vested interest like the physical relationship, because there is none. You have to understand that. In the secular world these days, it used to be a time where this was a point of debate. Today it's not a debate at all. Today virtually all relationships in the secular world are first and foremost physical. There's no question about that. Radically and very soon. Whereas in the religious world what happens is, that, and women have made two tragic mistakes. They've made one tragic mistake. Men have made a terrible mistake of battering women into this position of taking advantage of them radically, and women have allowed it to happen. There's no question about it. So that young women now are in a situation where they have been battered into giving away everything that there is to give in the relationship, and so there's nothing left. So what do they have left to barter with, to negotiate with? What's left in the relationship? After 3 or 4 or 5 years of a relationship like that, when it starts to mention marriage, she disappears usually. The last case my wife and I were involved with was a young girl who met a young boy when they were 18, just after they left school, and they set up a normal relationship like the secular world does, and they moved in together now, and 11 years later, when she was 29, she mentioned marriage, you know, she thought, you know, and he disappeared, didn't come back, okay? So now she's 29, she meant this as a lifetime commitment, she gave everything that she had, he was just doing what the normal secular kind of, that's the norm, unfortunately, that's the norm, it's a terrible thing. So the only way, obviously, to get into this kind of relationship is to set up rules which are, if you want me, then I'm prepared to consider giving myself to you, but what I want from you is the price that I need from you the rest of your life. Yes, we're not talking about a frivolous, because every frivolous relationship damages the sensitivity, it gives you an opportunity to compare in an invalid way. That's what men do after many relationships with women. What happens is they compare the wife that they finally married to the best details of every woman they ever knew. They completely forget about all the bad. Yes, and why those women threw them out, and they remember the best of each woman, and they compare their wife to the combination of the best features of everything. What woman can live up to that? So the whole situation is doomed to failure. Whereas in the frum situation, what happens is couple meet each other. The physical relationship cannot be a blinding factor because there is none. And not only that, the man cannot think only along physical lines, because what happens is the woman has to present herself in a very modest way. She cannot present herself in a way that it's hard enough even then for him to focus in a balanced fashion, but at least he has a chance. Because she has to focus, she has to present herself in a modest way. But she must be feminine. Because according to Jewish law, a woman may not wear men's clothing. So she has to be very feminine and present herself in an elegant and refined feminine way, but on the other hand, in an unphysical kind of a way. It's very ironic that nothing could be more feminist. The feminists always say that they don't want to be treated as objects. You're familiar with that statement. They want to be treated as an entire human being with all the depth that's involved. This is a system that's designed to do exactly that. A man is forced to focus on a woman as an entire human being. Can't focus only on one aspect of the relationship. So the whole thing is designed to get a relationship going in a balanced way. It's also designed that the relationship will progress in such a way that if it has to be dismantled, if they have to disentangle themselves from each other, that the emotional pain will be minimized. Instead of having given the kind of aspects and details to a relationship that should be reserved only for somebody that you want to give the rest of your life to, only a minimal engagement has been made, engagement of the two personalities, such that if they see that it's not going, the thing can be dismantled. Even then it's painful. Of course it's painful. But it's not like dismantling a relationship of intimacy of many years, as is common in the secular world. And I think you can figure it out for yourself. There's many other details to be said, but I think I hope I've conveyed at least the basic elements that make it a system that's got at least a chance of success. Let me spend a few minutes. You probably have some questions. Let me just mention one other area that I don't want to risk missing, and this is relevant to somebody who's not even thinking about a frum environment at all. No matter how secular your outlook, this is a subject that has to be understood. If you have questions, please note them down. I'll stop in a few minutes and you can ask questions. And that is, what criteria should we look for in somebody that you hope to marry? Or somebody, in a young person that you're advising, what should they look for in a person that they hope to marry? Whether it's a shidduch list type of thing that you're giving to a shotgun and saying, I want a person who's this and this and this, or whether it's just a young person themselves who are assessing somebody that they've met or somebody that they'd like to meet. What are the criteria? And here, Baruch Hashem, we can make a clear list of criteria. You can write these down and hang them up on your mirror or your child's mirror in the door of their bedroom, and you can stop. By the way, before I forget to say it, this list of criteria is not something that you lay on top of a child when they're 19 or whatever it is and about to get married. This is a list of criteria that you start instilling in their consciousness when they're 3 years old. Yes? When the child is young. When the child is very young, you start educating along the lines of these sensitivities so that the child will genuinely appreciate these things. You don't tell it to them when they... That means when the child is 5 years old or 6 years old or 7 years old and the mother's out with a little girl and they visit someplace, the mother should lean over to the child and say, "You see how helpful that young man is? How he helps his mother take off the table?" You follow? That's what you point out to a little girl, so that she grows up understanding that her mother admires a young man who's sensitive and helpful. That's the kind of thing you do. You do not point out to a young girl of five how closely he resembles a gorilla, you know, and how nice the cleft in his chin is, you follow? That is not the kind of thing that you develop. Obviously. Once a child is brought up with these sensitivities to see, hopefully if you have the right kind of home, you can lean over to your daughter and see how helpful dad is, how he takes off the table and helps mom. If you can do that, fine. If you can't do that, then of course you don't do it at home, you do it elsewhere, you point it out. It's not easy to find these days, but make sure you invite it to the kind of place where you do see that sort of thing, so you can lean over and say to your little girl of six. But the point is, you do that and you show a little girl how you respect the fact that the husband and wife show each other tremendous honor, how there's never any tension manifest when other people are present, the refinement with which they treat each other. All those things have to be made apparent to a child, and the child has to see the wisdom of it and appreciate it at a gut level as they grow, so that they appreciate these things. If a child grows up watching, you know, professional wrestling on television, and that's the, you know, for light relief, they watch mutant tortoises doing whatever it is that they do, the child's not exactly going to have role models, you know, of sensitive, refined individuals that they want to marry, and it's hopeless. Now, what are the criteria that should be instilled? So like this, when a person's considering whom they should marry in general, or a person that they've met, the criteria are as follows. First and foremost, there's no question about it. I'm not saying this is more important than anything else, but it comes first. First and foremost, is there a natural chemistry between the two people? Marriage is hard enough anyway, even when there is a natural attraction between two people. So first and foremost, and that's why people have to see each other at least before they get married, and that is there natural chemistry, including a strong physical attraction, at least above neutral? It doesn't have to be immediate. It doesn't have to be immediate. Sometimes a person sees a beauty in someone else after they've been with him for a while. There's nothing wrong with that. You can try it out for a while. But the point is, by the time you realize that this is going to be a meaningful or serious or ongoing relationship, you must be clear that there is a chemistry and a natural gut level, inexplicable, unexplainable physical and general personality attraction. That's an absolute requirement. By the way, this has many consequences, such as the fact that the people hardly, definitely don't appreciate this enough. The fact that if you contracted a marriage, women especially tend to forget it, men forget it plenty also, if you contracted a marriage where that was part of the relationship, and it definitely should be, you dare not let your physical appearance and the care that you take about your appearance and your particularly your weight change from what it was when you got married, because men especially feel betrayed. When women, again, limited how much we can talk about this, but women think that how much they make their face look nice is what's important, but it's almost irrelevant, I can tell you. Sorry to have to tell you that. Talk to me privately. Don't talk to me privately. The point is, men also make this mistake. Men often are in shape physically, and then after they get married, they dissolve out of shape, and women feel often also quite offended by that, the men don't understand. That's another subject, but it's important. Anyway, the point is this, that there has to be that natural physical or chemical attraction that has to somehow work. That is not the problem that you think it might be, because the Kabbalistic sources say that every woman has a tremendous beauty. Every woman has a special and wonderful beauty, and if a man can be made sensitive to see that, then anybody could be attracted to anybody. Right? Again, it's easier to do it where there's a natural feeling in the first place, but it doesn't have to be. But what women often misunderstand is that natural beauty that can be appreciated, especially by men, is not the kind of physical details or features that people conventionally think. They may be important also, but it's a certain inner light that shines from a woman. And that light comes from many things. It comes from a certain refinement, a certain dignity, a certain modesty with which she carries herself, with which she dresses herself. There's a certain glow that shines from a woman that is her beauty, that is not the conventional, or not only the conventional things that the secular world, unfortunately, thinks only skin deep, thinks about. In addition, there are many other factors that shine out as beauty in a woman, as attractive, gut-level chemical beauty from a woman, which is very hard to put into words, but a person should study the subject. And that is, for example, if a woman has a certain happiness about her, right? If a woman gives out a certain happiness, no matter what she's going through, even if her life is difficult, but if she gives out a certain positive vibe, that sums it all up. And it has to be natural, not somebody who's faking it or putting it on. That has to be the natural thing. And there's no question that you can feel that easily after you know the person for a while and you see them in a few situations, no matter how they're trying to put on a face, that definitely will come across. Most of the time, you'll see that a face is being put on. But there are moments of tension and moments when the natural personality comes through, and that is, you can watch the person with other people, with brothers and sisters, you can watch them with children, you can watch the person in many contexts that they may think they're not actually being judged, and you'll see whether a natural, loving, giving, kindly, gentle personality is forthcoming. With regard to this issue, there are some ways that some things a person can use. It's all common sense, isn't it? But sometimes young people need to be told, no? There are ways you can use to assess what is the inner depth of this issue if it's not immediately apparent, especially early in a relationship. Some of those criteria are as follows. First of all, obvious criteria are obvious mental problems. Right? That's something to avoid unless thought about very carefully. The person themselves or the family sometimes also. If there's been obvious emotional problems in the past, especially serious ones, even if they may have seemed to be taken care of now, should be a very important warning sign. We have to speak more about people who have particular physical or other handicaps. That also has to be discussed, because that's not a reason not to marry somebody at all. Sometimes, on the contrary, it can be a very big plus. We'll have to talk about that separately. But one criteria that you can use in this assessment of the person, their background and their personality, is to look at the family. Okay? Now, the way that works is as follows. The first message is you better build a healthy, happy, stable family so that when your daughter meets a young man who's heard this discussion, you know that he's looking at you, you want to think. There are many ways you can look at the family. So the Gemara says, for example, that if you want to know how a woman's sons will turn out, when a young man is looking for a woman, and he wants to know what kind of sons will he have, he should look at her brothers. You know that? The Gemara says, you can think about it in your own family, and you'll see. The Gemara says, huh? The Gemara says that if you want... shaking their heads when they think about their brothers. Anyway, the point is that... The point is, if you want to know how your sons will turn out, a woman, or a man wants to know how his sons, then they will have certain similarities with the woman's brothers. Useful thing to know. Again, I wouldn't cancel a marriage on the basis, you know, I think. And you have to make allowances for maybe the people are not from, and that is why they have certain values, but that's it. Another thing you should do is look at the parents' relationship, and I have to be very careful about this. And that's as follows. Unfortunately, there's a well-known sociological fact, many times proven, that people tend to repeat the mistakes of their parents. They tend to model their relationship, even involuntarily, on the breakdowns and the problems and the successes of their parents' relationship. Sometimes you see it dramatically. I mean, I know a family with a father and mother completely incompatible. They've got nothing in common at all. Opposite ends of the spectrum in personality-wise. And in that family, there happen to be four daughters. And the daughters say that they've never seen the parents disagree about anything ever. Never the slightest disagreement. The parents' bedroom door is closed always. They have their privacy. They've never seen the parents disagree in the slightest flicker of disagreement ever. They've never seen other than ultimate harmony. So happens that all four daughters are married, and they have wonderful relationships themselves. And it doesn't prove anything, but you see. The point is that it doesn't prove that opposites have to go together. No, it just so happens that in this case, the reason that this couple happened to make it so successfully is because they happen to be totally different and they acknowledge it and they deal with different areas. They just don't clash at all. He would never think of interfering in anything that she takes care of, and she does it fantastically. She wouldn't dream of entering his domain because she'd be hopeless at it. So they just don't cross wires at all. Fantastic system. That's to be discussed under marriage in general. The point is that people tend to reflect the mistakes of their parents, and if they see a breakdown in the parents' relationship, often it comes out in their own relationship. One of the most extreme forms of this, sadly and unfortunately, is when the relationship between the parents broke down entirely. Either a death, or a mental instability, or a divorce that happened especially before the children were about 15. Psychiatrically, it's been shown that a major upset, a major tragedy that happens to a child before they are 15 years old, approximately, you can't generalize too much, has a deep and lasting effect on the child. If it happens after that age, usually the child's attitude towards trust and relationships, especially trust, has been formed already, and therefore that breakdown happens as a pain, but doesn't crack their own inner being. Whereas if it happens when they're very small, often children lose their trust in the world in general. They think that they can't trust anybody since their father let their mother down, and that was the one person they thought they could trust unquestioningly. It leaves a suspicion, a suspiciousness, and a difficulty in relationships very often. It's a very, very sad thing. But the point is this, that no matter what age it happened, if there was a problem in the relationship with the parents, or there is a problem in the parents' relationship, it's something to be careful about, because often it has an effect in the child. Now, that's not always true by no means. And secondly, a place where there's a big exception, there are two exceptions. One is a young person who's sensitive to the issue, and they grow up with a conscious decision not to be like that. And if you see that apparent, you see that the person has got a healthy self-image and self-esteem, and they don't relate to the problems that the parents had in a negative way, that would be a positive factor. And more important than that is when a child becomes religious. When a child becomes oriented towards the Frum way of life, then very often what happens is they make a radical break with a set of values that the parents represented, and on the contrary, a breakdown in the parents' relationship often the child sees as explicitly a factor because the parents didn't have a Frum way of understanding things and going about things and a common goal, etc., etc., and they don't have that problem because they've chosen a whole new idea of what a role model should be, and very often you don't have a problem in that. And there are many other exceptions and details, but it is something to think about. In general, if you want to approach it just at a crude level, one of the best recommendations you can have about a young person is a normal, decent, ordinary, giving, loving South African from a normal, old-fashioned, ordinary South African family, right? With integrity, that still believes that your word is your bond, you know, that's still old-fashioned enough to worry about where the children are, you know, that those old-fashioned values, usually, even if a child does go through a rebellious phase, usually those things will come up. Beyond that, I'll just finish with this, beyond that criterion is another set of issues that are not critical as these issues are. In other words, you have the physical attraction that has to be there. Then you have the issue of these general characteristic personality issues. Those are critical issues. Then you have a list of things that are not critical. From here on in, the marriage, you can decide, up to that stage, you can decide whether to get married or not. However, after that decision, there's another set of things that don't have to break down the marriage or the chances of a successful marriage, but they have to be discussed before you get married. And that is a set of common understanding about many things that have to be thrashed out so they don't become terrible conflicts later. Many, many times people get married, they have wonderful basic factors of compatibility, and they don't discover until afterwards that a critical and important issue, they never bothered to make a contract on that issue. Right? And there are many, many things that are involved here. One, I'll just give you some of the classics. One is children. You find that they get married and it turns out that, you know, he wants her to be sterilized and she wants 25 children. They never discussed it before. Okay? You'd be surprised. I have a very close friend who's an accountant, who married a young lady who's a doctor, and after they get married, she told him that she of course intended to have no children. Yes, she wants to become a great famous dermatologist and her career comes first, and she doesn't want children. And he was heartbroken and took 12 years for her to change her mind. Okay? So, you know, that just wasn't an issue before. That has to be discussed. You can't, you know, you can't not discuss that kind of thing. A second classic issue is where you're gonna live. Okay? I don't mean, you know, Glen Hazel or Yeovil, you know, I mean Toronto or New Zealand, that's what I mean. And that has to be discussed because it's an issue that can cause great... And there are other things, if it's a religious family, how, where they will live in terms of sort of an attempt to make an income as opposed to learning in yeshiva, and how that will be balanced out, and mechanisms of earning a living and so on. These things have to be thrashed out in terms of... There are many other issues, relationship to family. Very often the package deal that you make when you get married includes in-laws who are... Not very often, more than very often... It includes in-laws who are at least in some degree problematic. Yes? The question is how lucky The question is how little they will interfere. Yes? How lucky you will be and to what degree, greater or less, they will interfere negatively. That is a package deal that you have to put up with. And therefore what has to be done, the couple have to maturely sit down and work out exactly how they'll define the relationship with the parents so that it's not an unnecessary tension. And there are many, many other issues that are a thing. Another important issue is how they'll divide roles. If there's a confusion about who'll be earning the living, or about who'll be maintaining certain of the role issues in the home, which Halacha does not define, Halacha allows you to make up your own system of who'll do what. In a default position, when you can't agree, Halacha does lay down that the woman will take care of the home entirely, and he's not allowed to interfere at all, and that he'll take care of all religious things, and she's not allowed to interfere at all. That's where you can't agree. That has to be done. But if you want, you can set it up another way. You know, if a woman wants to be a brain surgeon or a test pilot or something, and he wants to wash nappies, you know, you could do that. But it has to be agreed on before. And these are things that are not critical but have to be. One thing I forgot to mention last night, somebody asked me afterwards, is age. At what age does this become relevant? At what age should you get married? So all else being equal, as young as possible. Okay? all else being equal, as young as possible. 17, 18 is absolutely fine, there's no question about it. The younger you get married, the better. You want to get married, I said all else being equal, not when the couple are so immature that they'll have problems, or it's a person with certain secular hang-ups that you'll resent later, they didn't have certain other. There are obviously many, many, and sometimes financial issues are a point, but much less than people think. If parents would have the right attitude, instead of saying that you can get married when you can earn a living, which might mean 8 or 10 years later, after who knows what destruction and havoc has been wrought in a young man's life because he couldn't withhold himself from certain relationships, rather let the parents support the two of them together, just like they're supporting the individual individually. Let them support them on a basic scale while the two of them are together and building a relationship. Why not do that if parents were enlightened about this issue? But all else being equal, it makes sense to get married younger. It takes care of certain problems and dangers that a person might be exposed to. If they're not married in this terrible secular environment, it means that they can mold their personalities together instead of having to adjust to a personality. You know what it's like to marry somebody 35 years old? A 35-year-old bachelor, yes? A 35-year-old bachelor has got a head of cement. You can't, when you marry him, yes? You know what happens? When the first day they get married, she puts a tablecloth on the table, he can't handle it. Why? Because he's been eating supper every night, a greasy hamburger on the yellow pages. When he finishes the hamburger, it turns out the page. No, that's his tablecloth. You know, now she wants a frilly tablecloth and they can't handle that, you know. But if you get him before he's aware of these issues, when he's 18 and he doesn't know any better, then you can grow him up with a sensitivity to this. So all else being equal, it pays to get married young so that you can grow together and mold person. That's not an absolute rule by any means, but we shouldn't be afraid. The Gemara says quite clearly, the Mishnah says that a boy of 18 should get married. 18 years old is old enough to get married. We don't follow that rule as a halacha, as an absolute requirement, but it's something to think about. Are there questions that... Yes, please.
Is there anything in halacha that says that a younger daughter can't get married before an older daughter?
Not that I know of. It might be a derech eretz or a nice way to do things, but... Yeah, I'm not an expert about that, but...
Not a problem. And do you include that sort of period of knowing each other? Do you believe in long engagement? Do you believe in engagement as part of it?
Again, there's no reason to have a long engagement at all. Once there's commitment been made, that means an engagement means you're going to get married, so it doesn't make any sense at all to prolong an engagement. In Gemara times, they used to have lengthy engagements, and there the Gemara says that they very often had an engagement of a year. But it was an engagement after a formal... The first half of the marriage ceremony was done already. In other words, in a relationship with somebody else would have been adultery in Torah terms at that time. And they used to use the year for preparation. The woman would build a trousseau and get ready, and they built, you know, but that was, there were times it was done like that. But we should not have a long engagement if possible, because it's just a frustration and unnecessary.
To what extent do you think about children, do they have problems? I mean, it's not as though they were brought up with it. Yeah. How does the secular world sort of conflict?
The general question of how the Baal Teshuva gets into problems, I don't want to take too long about it, and I suggest that we did make a recording once of a discussion. I think it's called, they called it newly observant social integration or something, which discusses the problems of people who switch into a more religious mode and sometimes hit certain problems and obstacles. But in general, yes, it is a problem. People who become more religious from a secular way of life have a number of problems. One area, just to relate to today's discussion, one common area that people hit as a problem is that they tend to try to do things according to an ideal and according to certain rules, and they forget the good old-fashioned natural human values. Added to that is the problem that we are dealing with young people who don't have often the basic natural things that the South African generation, one generation ago or two, had as a natural thing in heavy dosage. In other words, very briefly, if you think about it, you work it out for yourself, you'll see that your parents or grandparents, in the South African context, almost always were people who, even though they weren't religious at all, and that's what happened, the generation that came over from Europe lost basically the dedication to Torah learning, and they lost the keeping of mitzvahs, but they definitely did not lose what it means to be a mensch. That means they retained a very, very rich awareness of what it means to have commitments. The marriage, the divorce rate was very low. There was a sense of commitment, of obligation, of responsibility. Children came first to an incredible degree in terms of sacrifice. Your word was your bond. If you half said a word in business, You maintain that there's no question, whereas today, if a person even signs that, I don't mean it in the first place. There's no question that it was a totally different world in terms of values. So the people who grew up then had a halfway decent chance of making a marriage that had some internal dynamism to it, compared to today, where there's a completely superficial view. So here you have this generation that are shattered in terms of, they don't have a concept that your word is your honor, and that there was a generation 100 years ago, a person would die rather than contravene their own honor, you know, to even commit suicide rather than go against something that, whereas today, of course, you don't, you know, that's taken as nonsense. And therefore, you're dealing with a generation that doesn't have inequalities often, even though the parents may have, but somehow didn't come across. They don't have an inner sense of Jewishness compared. They don't understand what's wrong with a non-Jewish relationship. That takes time to get that idea across. And in addition, they're now functioning according to a certain set of rules. Right? And when you function according to rules and you leave out the emotions and you don't function spontaneously, and I don't want to go into detail, but very often in a Baal Teshuva marriage, the intimate side of a marriage sometimes is problematic because that's an area that is fraught with secular overtones and memories, and they want to function according to rules, and it sometimes gets very, very complicated. And there are other areas also. So yes, there can be problems. Usually the norm is that they get worked through and they go through a bumpy period of trying to adjust emotions to the rules, and usually what happens is that the with time in the frum world, people adjust and the norm becomes the norm and things become okay. But it can be problematic, yeah. To try and smooth out... this is a heavy, heavy issue, again. The question is not only people from different countries or cultures, okay? Sometimes this problem arises, two people from the same culture understand each other very well, they get confused with a go-between. A go-between can be very, very useful. Somebody who can, it's such a beautiful refinement of the Torah system that instead of having to break up with somebody in a coarse way and make them feel rejected, yes, for example, just giving you an idea, what happens is after a couple of meetings, you don't even have to say anything negative to the person. The person that you're working with expresses to the other person that it didn't work out for whatever reasons, and no one's offended, and everybody understands. Beautiful idea. So they can be a very useful person. Sometimes they're personal questions that have to be checked out that you feel you can't ask openly, and the go-between that you're working with, sometimes two people, a man and a woman, can sensitively find out those issues. Yes, it's fantastic. However, sometimes it's misused. Sometimes people get involved with the go-between idea in a very, very unkosher way. Most explicitly, when they go to Kabbalists for an assessment of their handwriting or their palm creases or their names to know whether they're compatible or not. The Torah leaders of this generation and the previous one were violently against that. Violently against it. There was a couple who went to a certain Kabbalist and he heard their names and he said, "You're terrible, you could never marry your help," and they were heartbroken, devastated. They went to the Stifler and he went crazy. In fact, it's recorded in Rav Hillel's book. He went crazy and he started and he gave them a bracha. They got married, a happy marriage, no problem. Not to say that he wasn't accurate, the Kabbalist. But we do not function on that level, and we definitely should not do it. Superstitious, it's making a cheap, superficial nonsense out of Torah instead of, yes, and therefore that obviously shouldn't be there. But to assess personality, yes, it should be that, it could be that if you have a person you can rely on who is very perceptive and that you rely on, you sometimes can take the person to meet that individual, and they can sometimes feed back very useful information, but it's a sensitive thing and has to be very carefully done. So you have to do the best you can. If you can spend time with that person again in all the aspects of the relationship that I mentioned, then you make do with that. If you can afford the time and cost, etc., of a trip to meet family, which will be done anyway, that's a wonderful way of getting to know the person also, and there's no reason why you couldn't do that, if there's no reason why you couldn't do it. But if not, you have to do the best you can. So yes, you are functioning with a person who has two problems. One is you don't see the environment, and two, the person's from a different cultural background, which is a massive issue. I didn't say a massive problem, but a massive issue. It's hard enough getting on with somebody where you have a common, completely common language and understanding. When the person's from another country, yes, you have a sometimes massive issues that are undiscovered until much, much later, that is just a slight wavelength difference in what comes in. If it's an American, for example, he needs a whole dictionary to translate for them. Yes? You know? And therefore, that can be an issue and has to be attacked more sensitively than it would be when, you know, it's the boy next door. Yeah. Is there any more questions? I just wanted to mention... Yes, please. Go ahead. I wanted to mention one thing that I didn't mention, that is sometimes there is a personal problem. A person has a physical handicap or some particular problem that's not uncommon, and a person has to know how to handle it. Very briefly, you should know this. A person has a problem, let's exclude mental problems now, because that's a specific area that has to be discussed separately. But let's talk now about a physical handicap or some other issue that is a particular strongly defined disadvantage or handicap. First of all, that shouldn't exclude the person at all, because very often people who have to cope with that sort of thing have a fantastic advantage. They have a sensitivity and a maturity that people who've had it easy don't have at all. So by no means is that a reason not to marry somebody. However, what is important is the question about whether they should announce it. At what stage should the other party be told? What's the halacha? What is the requirement? In terms, I've dealt with many people who have had some particular problem, a major problem, and the question always was, when we agree to meet someone, should they know about this problem or not? And the answer is surprising, and it's probably something like this. First of all, let's be clear, before you marry, the person has to be told about it. Otherwise, it's called a mekartos. It means it's an invalid deal. The marriage is invalid if there's something major that the person didn't know about, especially in the area of fertility and things like that. And other areas too. However, so definitely has to be told. The question is, at what point? That's the question. At what point of the relationship should you tell this other person? And there's many, many factors. First of all, you don't want to go around announcing things that other people don't have to know about. Sometimes there are genetic problems. A young lady came up to me recently. She's committed to marry a certain person, and she's a Tay-Sachs carrier. Now, should they test the young man or not? They decided to get married already. These are very, very important issues. Of all the people in this room, there are probably one or two who Tay-Sachs carriers, right? The carrier rate is 1 in 20 or 30, and people should be screened for that, okay? You can speak to me privately if you want to know how to do that. The point is that you don't want people to know about these things unnecessarily. Another person, the person has to know about it. You don't want them to be... What do you do exactly? So the answer in general, and there's no absolutely general answer, but a very, very well-tried and tested method of going about it is this. That initially should not mention the problem. First of all, it's nobody's business to know about a personal issue when the relationship may not last for more than a day or a week. So there's no need to go about it. Secondly, more important, very often, especially if the problem is gross or a major problem, a person has a personality, all of us are like this, that if you hear of somebody with a problem, you don't see a person, you just see a problem. You cannot relate to the individual as a human being. You see a massive problem with a little human being appended someplace on the edge. That's all you see. And therefore, you probably refuse to meet the person, and it's just a no-go from the beginning. Whereas, if you meet the person as a human being and you get to feel that they're a human being, then you hear that there's a problem. Usually what happens is, you see the problem in context, small, and generally you'll be amazed the person doesn't even hear the problem. They don't even see it as a problem. You can't believe the situations. I don't want to embarrass people by telling you, but I've been involved in situations with major, major problems, gross, major handicaps, where the person didn't mention it, the person either didn't see it in the beginning, it wasn't the kind of thing you could see, or even they saw the thing, but they saw a human being. And in all the cases I've been involved with, people actually got married. I'll tell you one of the most extreme, is a young man approached me a few months ago, about a year ago, to ask me if I could suggest somebody that would be suitable for him. Why? Because he just lost his wife, sometime before, a young woman, and he wanted to get married again. What was the story? The story was like this. Unbelievable story. The story was that he met a young woman. They suggested. They met. They liked each other. And after they got to know each other, she told him that she had terminal cancer. She was dying. She was dying. Sartan. Katlani. She told him that's what she had. It didn't cause a flinch. He married her. Went ahead. Proposed to her, they got married, 4 years later she died, and he told me he would never have done it any differently, he doesn't regret a second, it was fantastic, it was exactly the right thing. Can you imagine? Now imagine if somebody had approached that young man initially and said, listen, I've got a young girl that I'd like you to meet, she's about to die, you know, would you like to meet her? What would the person say? Very unlikely that he would have. But when he was presented to a beautiful, wonderful human being, there was no second thought in his mind. It's a remarkable thing. Remarkable thing. So therefore, the general suggestion should be that, there are many exceptions. Sometimes it's a particular handicap that the person needs to meet somebody else very specific because of that. There are many, many issues like that, especially when it's in the fertility area because there are problems. If a woman can't have children, then a certain things have to be taken into account as to whom she can marry and how they'll do it. That is specific areas, otherwise not. Did you want to ask something?